that's out there that people feel they can say anything?
In today's Business Daily, we take a look at so-called youngism and how and why younger generations now may face more age discrimination than younger generations of the past.
So pretty much they just said that it was my age, that they completely used age as a reason for why I wasn't fit to be a diplomat.
That's Priscilla Bonsu. When she was 22, she completed an internship at an embassy in Washington, D.C. When she had finished, she was told she was too young to go any further.
I didn't expect my age to be the issue. When I was told that I was too young, I just felt like it was inaccurate. I actually felt like my age helped me in a lot of situations. For example, like the college campus projects that we were working on, I think because of my age, I actually knew things or saw things that people that I was working for didn't see. I knew what young people in my age were listening to, what kind of music and pop culture and all these things. And I thought that would be interesting for the students on campus and for them to, I just found a way to kind of connect both groups. And instead, my ideas were completely dismissed. And then during the feedback conversation, I was just told that I'm very young. After that, I just felt like, why should I even try to work there? If I get this sort of feedback, then maybe that is just not the place for me, to be honest.
Priscilla now lives in New York and works as a legal advisor for an international law firm. But her experience has stayed with her. And it's the same for many other young people.
When I spoke to my colleagues, I would say my age, obviously, in conversation, and they would be really shocked and sometimes undermine the things that I've done or treat me younger than I actually am. Obviously, I'm 19, so I'm an adult.
19-year-old Nadira Hussein is a first-year student at King's College London.
I felt like I was being treated like a little girl sometimes, especially being in an environment where everyone else is older than you. It can be hard to be taken seriously.
Did you feel that your gender came into it ever, the fact that you're a young woman?
I would say definitely. There's been times where, like, for instance, I've been a TV presenter for this kids' educational talk show. And once there was a conflict happening on set, and I wasn't involved in it, it was with two other colleagues. And my boss was very violent and very aggressive. Because of how aggressive it was, I did start like tearing a bit, because I felt so powerless in this situation where I didn't know how to act in a way that would be useful. And so afterwards, then people started making fun of me, saying that this is what happens when women are on set. And then I was made fun of being called a crybaby, despite the fact that I'm 19 years old. So I didn't appreciate that. And it was quite hard.
How important is language and the language that people use? For example, have you ever been referred to as a girl in the workplace because you are
Yes, definitely I have, especially because with my experience as a talk show presenter, I was for a kids educational talk show, and so obviously you have that sort of persona on TV. And so because I would have to speak in a more happy, positive way on camera, it was easier for them to think of me as younger. And so they would call me a girl in a derogatory way, to say like girl, as though you're not as responsible or as adult. So I definitely think, yeah, there probably is a language problem, not just in the workplace, but just generally speaking.
Whenever you had any of these experiences, did you feel that you could report them or take it further up the chain in whatever company that you were in?
It was hard. Sometimes I felt like I shouldn't. Sometimes it took a while for me to speak up about the questions that I've had or the experiences that I've had, just because I wasn't sure how my bosses or the older people in the company would react. But then even in those situations where I did speak up, people would say, oh, well, you're not taking this seriously if you get offended by this, or you know what I mean? And so I felt like, oh, how do I... Now I put myself in a place where people think I'm not taking my job seriously. And so I just felt like, oh, how do I fix this situation? And it was just really tough.
Nadira clearly felt that it was because of her youth that she was treated in this way. And Priscilla, who we heard from before, felt that was the reason why she didn't get the job. But how do you know for sure you're being discriminated against because of your age? Elizabeth Horton is a career coach based outside of Sydney in Australia, working with under 35-year-olds around the world. And this is a question she gets asked a lot.
You know what you're capable of. If you've got a job description in front of you and you go through it and go, actually, I've had exposure to all of those things. I have evidence to prove I can do all of those things. And then they still say you don't have enough experience. I would say that's against your age. That's not against what you can and can't do, unless they can give you back feedback and examples as to, well, why is your experience not good enough in terms of your capability and the exposure in which you've had to certain things?
Do young men and young women experience ageism differently?
Yes, 100%, which is a real shame. It is a real, real shame that this we continue on this kind of not quite equal situation. I would say it plays out more for women. I feel women definitely, from what I've seen and through the clients I work with, struggle with ageism so much more, but for probably a slightly different reason. We all have children at some stage, not all of us, but we might choose to. And I think that plays out as an unconscious bias in some people's minds of, oh, she hasn't done it yet, so she might do it in a couple of years. And what stability is that going to give us? So I no longer believe it's a conscious fault. But then there's this certain age bracket we hit, and the men start to progress and the women are held back.
You're being very generous by saying you truly believe it's unconscious bias. But
yeah,
there's clearly conscious bias out there, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah, there has to be. There has to be conscious bias out there. I just like to think that most people do the right thing, and there's going to be a few hiring managers out there that are not doing the right thing, and they're allowing their bias to cloud that judgment.
Career coach Elizabeth Horton. Ageism is traditionally seen as something that affects older workers, but the reverse is very real. Lauren Stiller-Raclean is a consultant and trainer focused on creating an inclusive workplace, especially when it comes to gender, diversity and age. She's also the author of You Raised Us, Now Work With Us, a book about millennials in the workplace. She says while ageism against older people is also a massive problem, ageism against young people is so often more accepted.
If you changed someone's age for their race or gender identity or religion or anything else, they would never say the things that they do say in the age context.
Why do you think it is a very accepted form of discrimination, or at least people don't fear any retribution if they discriminate against young people in the workplace?
It's not one of the issues that we tend to talk about enough. People toss it off as something that has to do with the stage of life somebody is going through. And, well, it'll change when they get older, without really understanding and thinking in a more nuanced way about what is the behavior being identified and what does it mean for the future workforce that really may be saying something profoundly different than, I'm going to complain about a young person until the next younger generation comes along, and then I'll complain about them.
Do you think millennials and the Gen Z age groups, do you think they face more or different discrimination than previous younger generations?
Yes, I do. And I think for a couple of reasons, some of these reasons I did write about in my book, You Raised Us, Now Work With Us. By and large, younger generations today are raised differently than their parents were in terms of input into family decision making, choices in their lives. Certainly technology is a huge part. The way in which they may have a much more structured childhood, much more structure in schooling and programming, even the, you know, even play is programmed in a way that it wasn't for prior generations. So I think that all of these changes means that people are raised differently. If you're raised differently, then you behave differently than somebody, you know, that came before you. And one of the biggest changes that has come from this, I think, is a greater focus on work-life integration. People always talk about work-life balance, and I always think of it in terms of integration because we're talking about how people want to integrate their personal lives and their family lives and their work lives in a much more holistic and healthy way than prior generations did. But that reads to somebody who's older, who maybe sacrificed too much in the workplace, who maybe made choices that they're regretting now, it reads very differently. And so there's a tendency to dismiss it and not understand what I think is probably the greatest contribution that younger generations today are making to the workplace, which is a fundamental shift in priorities.
So Lauren Ricolin thinks today's younger generations are faring worse than other younger generations before them. But can this really be true? According to a study to be printed in August in the Journal of Experimental Psychology, published by the American Psychological Association, Lauren may be right. After surveying nearly 6,000 people in the US and the UK, Michael North, one of the study's authors, argues that ageism affects young people now more than ever before.
We started by just asking people, what are words that come to mind when you think of today's younger generation? What you do is you ask that very open-ended question first, and then progressively you ask different audiences, how much do they agree with the words that are sort of in the pot? And little by little, you sort of winnow down what starts out with a lot of words to what turns out to be more of a few words. And ultimately, what we learn from this exercise is that people see younger adults both positively and negatively. And I want to be clear, it's today's younger adults, not younger adults in general. So in general, on the positive side, they see today's younger adults as resourceful. They see them as ambitious. They see them as intelligent. They see them as hip or cool. They see them as tech savvy. But on the other hand, they also see them as ungrateful. They see them as coddled or disrespectful or what we deem naively radical. So that's sort of one wing of the study. The other wing, which may be even more straightforward, is we ask people straight up, to what extent do you feel warm or cold feelings? In other words, how much do you like certain people? This is what is known as a feelings thermometer. It's a very common metric of social perception. What we found is that people are coldest in their attitudes toward today's younger adults, even compared to today's older adults. And I think even more interestingly, personally, people are coldest in feelings toward today's younger generation, even in comparison to prior generations' younger adults. People of all ages still harbor these more negative views toward today's younger adults compared with prior generations' younger adults. So this is what our study was unpacking, this idea of youngism. And it does seem like there is a unique flavor to the particularly harsh attitudes that target today's younger adults.
So then why do you think today's younger generations fare so much worse than previous younger generations?
There have been various media narratives of what, again, I'm calling for shorthand millennial bashing, but you could apply it to today's younger adults in general, of being responsible for their plight. And let me get to their plight in a second. Let's just say whatever hardships that younger generations tend to face, they tend to get blamed for it, given this time-honored tradition of blaming the young. When it comes to millennials, for whatever reason, in the media, there have been popular narratives of, for example, oh, you can't afford to buy a house. Well, maybe you should buy less avocado toast. Or, you know, you're younger in today's society. You should have more respect for the traditions or the traditional institutions that have come before you. And there's this perception that there is a sort of lack of respect with the millennial generation. So I think it is a combination of derogating younger generations seems to be just a reflexive thing that older generations do in general. But when it comes to today's younger generation, you could argue this is the most economically disadvantaged younger generation in some time, in the sense that today's younger generation faces the very real plight of likely at this point not reaching the same kind of economic and social heights as their parents' generations. So given people's tendency to blame younger generations already for their plight, it makes sense that that kind of blame would intensify.
Michael North, assistant professor at the Stern School of Business at New York University. It's clear that ageism is real, although incredibly hard to deal with if you're at the brunt of it. So what are you supposed to do if you're in that situation? I put that question to career coach Elizabeth Horton.
Don't allow it to knock your confidence. Step into what you are capable of. So be really clear on the exposure you have had to certain things throughout your career and what you can and can't do, and be able to bring the conversation back to what you can actually do and what you have done and your potential to continue to grow and learn. It doesn't need to become a conversation around experience in terms of numbers of years. Bring that experience conversation back to what you have actually done. So if you have experienced any form of age discrimination, don't allow it to knock your confidence. Keep going for the roles and always pull the conversation back to what you have actually had exposure to, not the number of years that you have been in the workplace. Talk about what it is you have done.
What about the fear of reporting it within the organization that you work, you know, not wanting to be seen as the troublemaker, knowing that you're a victim of age discrimination, but worried that if you do report it, that's also not going to help your career?
I would say if you're in an organization and you think reporting something isn't going to help your career, you're in the wrong organization. Why do you want to work for that business if they are not going to support you? Why do you want to work for that leader? It might not be the whole business. It might just be that you've got not the best leader. So if you actually did report it, it would be treated in the right way. But if you are in an organization where you have that fear of reporting, it's the wrong business for you.
Career coach Elizabeth Horton finishing this edition of Business Daily. I'm Tamsin Ford. Our producer today is Frey Lindsay. If you want to get in touch with me, I'm on Twitter at Tamsin_Ford. And for more, please download our Business Daily podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Witness History from the BBC World Service with me, Alex Last. And today we look back at the life of a man whose ideas on how to prevent economic collapse transformed the 20th century and are still relevant today. The economist John Maynard Keynes.
I began by saying that the grand experiment has begun. If it works, I predict that we shall never go back all the way to the old state of affairs.
This is a rare recording of John Maynard Keynes, one of the great minds of the 20th century, a founding father of macroeconomics, a mathematician, a financier, and champion of the arts, whose ideas shaped our world, and whose ideas still matter today.
He was a kind of Confucius behind the political facade. I mean, he was certainly, in my view, the greatest economist of the 20th century. He was also one of the greatest minds because he was more than an economist.
Lord Robert Skidelsky is Emeritus Professor of Political Economy at Warwick University and a biographer of Keynes.
He showed governments a way of preventing economic collapses like the Great Depression of the 1930s. And that was supremely important politically, because if you remember, in the Great Depression, you had in Germany 6 million unemployed, and Hitler came to power. So in order to prevent these extreme political events, you had to be able to stop depressions. That was, I think, the lesson he taught, and I think it was adopted by most governments. We haven't had any repetition of that calamitous type of event since the 1930s.
Born in 1883 at the height of the British Empire to middle-class academic parents, John Maynard Keynes studied mathematics at Cambridge University before moving into the field of economics and then into government. And it was clear to everyone that Keynes was rather extraordinary, as his friend and colleague Sir Frank Lee told the BBC in the 1950s.
He was indubitably a genius, in the sense that when he cared, he could do anything incomparably well. His mind was so quick, so rapier-like, that he could see solutions where others could only see difficulties. You really did feel that you'd been with someone with gifts which transcended the exercise of ordinary abilities.
But Keynes was a bit of a dissident. His circle of friends were writers, artists, philosophers and painters of the Bloomsbury Group in London, and he shared in their modernist, rational, if rather radical, bohemian outlook. His private life was nonconformist too. He was bisexual in a time when homosexuality was illegal and taboo. But in his 40s, he fell in love with a Russian ballerina, Lydia Lopakova. They remained happily married to the end. He was an ardent, generous supporter of the arts. Among his close friends was Virginia Woolf and her husband, the publisher Leonard Woolf.
He was very slim and he was ugly in the face. He had extraordinarily intelligent eyes, which were also slightly like a very faithful dog. He was the most rational person with a tremendously powerful and supple mind. And yet he had also this curious, mischievous, boyish, almost, well, like what I believe is a leprechaun.
Keynes first really became famous after he quit the government and wrote a book in 1919 attacking the Allies' crippling economic punishment of Germany after the First World War. He went back to academia, was a public intellectual, and made a fortune playing the stock market. But it was his response to the years of mass unemployment and misery of the Great Depression of the 1930s that became his most famous legacy. In 1936, he published The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, which upended prevailing economic theory and advocated intervention to end such a crisis.
The core idea is very simple, and that is that a capitalist market economy is unstable because of uncertainty. Private sector either spends too little or too much, so there's a shortage of purchasing power. So the government fills that gap by its own spending. It just adds to the spending power or subtracts from the spending power of the private sector. And in that way, it stabilizes the economy at more or less full employment.
In times of hardship, he argued, government should not tighten their belts and wait for the market to correct itself, as classical economists insisted. Instead, he said government should borrow money, run a deficit and spend it to stimulate the economy. This would increase demand, jobs would be created, and he said there would be a multiplier effect as workers had money to spend on other things, leading to further investment and full employment.
He thought that normally, you know, an unmanaged economy suffers from perpetual underemployment. It doesn't use up all the resources, human resources, that it could. And that's why the government has a crucial role to play. Now, that was a new idea for government. People did not have that idea before Keynes spelt it out. What they tended to do when there was a depression was to cut their own spending, and that made things worse, because private sector was spending too little, then the government cut its own spending, and that of course made the depression worse than it would have been. So his idea was exactly opposite to the conventional wisdom of the day.
His ideas, though controversial, proved profoundly influential on young economists on both sides of the Atlantic. One of them was J.K. Galbraith at Harvard.
The general theory promised an escape from the horrors of unemployment, price deflation, and depression, and left the basic institutions of the society intact. Here was a marvelous non-revolutionary alternative to Marx, and that was the great appeal of Keynes.
The power of the theory was so great, starting from these very, very simple common sense ideas, that they were won over. And young economists of the time in the 1930s said it was like, you know, entering heaven again. Economics could be useful. It didn't have to tell you that the only way to recovery was to make everyone poorer.
In the 1930s, the US, under Roosevelt's New Deal, started to adopt Keynesian policies. And when Britain spent money to rearm in case there was a Second World War, Keynes saw a chance to see his theory in practice. As he said on the BBC, it was a great experiment.
If expenditure on armaments really does cure unemployment, I predict that we shall never go back all the way to the old state of affairs. If we can cure unemployment for the wasted purposes of armaments, we can cure it for the productive purposes of peace. Good may come out of evil. We may learn a trick or two which will come in useful when the day of peace comes, as in the fullness of time it must.
But Keynes would not see much of the return to peace. Suffering from heart disease, he died in 1946 at the age of just 62. He left a considerable legacy, much more than can be said here. But lastingly, his ideas did become central to most Western government economic policy for decades, until Keynesian economics fell from favor during the stagflation period of the 1970s. But the financial crises of recent years have seen something of a comeback, and once again the policies of John Maynard Keynes have been shaping our world.
Whenever there's a shock to the economy, like the financial crisis of 2008-2009, like the COVID-19 shock, people turn to governments and they say, well, you know, it's the government's job to make sure there isn't another Great Depression. And on the whole, that's what's happened. The Keynesian policy, you know, was adopted by most governments. I'm not saying we've solved the problem, but the important thing was to stop the depression. And that, I think, is where the relevance of Keynes is.
Lord Skidelsky, ending this edition of Witness History with me, Alex Last. For more of our history programmes, just search online for BBC Witness History.
I don't think that after this year I will continue to teach in my district.
Almost half of all new teachers will quit within their first 5 years. So states and even private companies have opened up more pathways to getting into the profession.
I did it online.
But many schools still face shortages.
The use of emergency certified teachers has become a new normal for Oklahoma schools.
Listen for Who Wants to Be a Teacher from APM Reports.
An hour-long special Wednesday morning at 11 o'clock here on WBEZ.
Head to WBEZ.org/shop and you'll find a wide array of great items, some even with the retro WBEZ logo. Your new favorite shirt or mug is waiting at WBEZ.org/shop.
This is the BBC World Service on WBEZ HD Chicago 91.5 FM, WBEQ HD Morris 90.7 FM, WBEK Kankakee 91.1 FM, and always on the WBEZ app.
Coming up after the news on the BBC World Service, it's Hard Talk with me, Stephen Sacker. Months of conflict in northern Ethiopia have cost thousands of lives and brought hunger and fear to millions. Late last year, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government seemed confident of crushing Tigrayan rebel forces. That confidence was misplaced. The war has spread. Both the Addis government and the rebels stand accused of horrifying war crimes. My guest is Ethiopia's Attorney General, Gedeon Timoteos. Is his government leading the country to disaster?
It's not falling apart. You have to remember, this is a very ancient and very resilient nation. We have overcome all sorts of challenge in our long history when we come united. And I believe there is a determination and resolve to neutralize the threat we face from the TPLF. We can overcome this challenge.
That's Gedeon Timoteos on Hard Talk after the news.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. The German army says a member of the Afghan security forces has been killed in a gunfight at Kabul airport. It said US and German troops had been involved alongside the Afghan guards. Dan Johnson has the latest.
We know that US forces joined German soldiers in fighting back alongside some Afghan guards. And it's one of those guards that's been killed, three of them injured. Now, we understand that they are part of a contingent of Afghan forces that were actually left behind at the airport, refusing to surrender to the Taliban and agreeing to assist the international forces with the evacuation, helping to protect the airport. Apparently, they have an agreement that once the evacuation is finished, they'll be able to fly off with the last of the evacuees so that they won't have to surrender to the Taliban. But at least one of them has lost his life this morning.
The Taliban have said they will not extend the deadline for Western forces to leave Afghanistan. Their political spokesman insisted the 31st of August was a red line. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson is expected to ask President Biden to delay the US troop withdrawal to allow more time for evacuations from Kabul airport. Britain's Foreign Office Minister James Cleverly said his government was facing a predicament.
The thing that I think we've all learnt over the last week or so is that the timelines around which we plan are not always completely in our own control. Now, obviously, the more time that we've got, the more people we can evacuate, and that's what we're pushing for.
The US Vice President Kamala Harris, who's visiting Singapore, has reaffirmed the United States' enduring commitment to Asia on a trip that's been overshadowed by events in Afghanistan. Speaking alongside the Singaporean Prime Minister, Ms. Harris reiterated Washington's commitment to freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. China claims almost all of the sea as its own, despite overlapping territorial claims by several countries in the region. The Chinese government recorded no new local COVID-19 infections on Monday, indicating they've brought recent outbreaks under control. They were linked to the highly contagious Delta variant. Stephen McDonnell reports from Beijing.
The symbolic return to zero new local infections has not been met with great fanfare in China. But it's a far cry from the situation a few weeks ago, when a fresh outbreak in the eastern city of Nanjing spread to dozens of towns and cities. Some have questioned the veracity of China's official numbers, with pressure on local governments to underestimate infections, which might reflect badly on their performance. However, in trend terms, the statistical curve does seem to have been matching real-world evidence. Despite the success of the elimination strategy, some senior health experts here have said that eventually China will have to shift its strategy away from a zero cases target to one of living with the coronavirus.
World news from the BBC. Taiwan has started distributing its first locally produced vaccine, despite concerns it was approved before a phase three clinical trial was carried out. The island's president, Tsai Ing-wen, was seen receiving her dose of the Medigen jab in a live broadcast on social media. It's part of Taiwan's plan for self-sufficiency because of delays in vaccine deliveries from global drug companies. Officials in the US state of Tennessee say at least two young children are among more than 20 people known to have died in flash flooding. A search and rescue operation is underway to locate dozens still missing. Roads and bridges were washed away. Tennessee's Governor Bill Lee said the community of Waverly was one of the worst hit.
There's been a record number of inches of rainfall over Friday night and Saturday morning that created devastating flooding in this community. Tremendous loss of life, a number of missing people on the ground, homes washed off their foundations, cars strewn around the community. It is a devastating picture of loss and heartache.
The lawyer for Bolivia's former interim president, Jeanine Añez, says her client harmed herself in a cry for help after being charged with genocide on Friday. The authorities in Bolivia said Ms. Añez had cuts on her arms and described it as a suicide attempt. She had been in jail in La Paz since March, accused of responsibility for the killing of 22 indigenous protesters in November 2019, shortly after she assumed office. Ukraine is hosting an international summit on Crimea as it seeks to keep up diplomatic pressure to regain control of the peninsula after its annexation by Russia 7 years ago. Delegations from more than 40 countries and organizations are taking part in Kyiv, with Russia has dismissed the summit. That's the latest world news from the BBC.
Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. My guest today swapped an academic career in the law for a high-profile government position and is now feeling more political heat than he could possibly have bargained for some 3 years ago. Gideon Timoteos was appointed Attorney General by Ethiopia's Nobel Peace Prize-winning Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. At the time, the Ethiopian government was making much of its commitment to modernization and national reconciliation. Today, that agenda seems to have been overtaken by events, notably an intensifying internal conflict in the north of the country, which could, if not halted, threaten the very unity of the country. Last November, the Ethiopian army moved into the northern region of Tigray to remove the regional government led by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the movement which dominated the national government for decades before the current PM came to power. The result? A bitter conflict in Tigray, which has now spilled into the neighbouring regions of Amhara and Afar, and it's drawn in forces from neighbouring Eritrea in support of the Addis government. Thousands have been killed. There's disturbing evidence of atrocities committed on both sides, and the fighting has left
hundreds of thousands facing the very real threat of famine. A couple of years ago, the Ethiopian government was basking in the warmth of international approval. Now its handling of this internal conflict is prompting accusations and condemnation. What went wrong? Well, Gedeon Timoteos joins me now from Addis Ababa. Welcome to Hard Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Now, when we last spoke to each other nearly 9 months ago, you seemed very confident that your government was about to crush the forces of the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Are you now prepared to say that your government's strategy has gone disastrously wrong?
Mr. Sacker, as I have stated back then, we are in a position to retake Mekelle, and we're able to finalize the initial phase of the operation within a matter of 3 weeks. We took over Mekelle, we established an interim administration, we invested on rehabilitating Tigray. And remember, it was a conflict that was forced upon us. It was not a conflict that we got into by our own volition and willingness. So that's how we see the situation.
Well, you haven't answered my question, because since then, and of course your forces did take Mekelle, since then things have gone very wrong. Your forces left Mekelle in June, and since then the TPLF, the Tigrayan rebel forces, have retaken much of Tigray from your national army, but they've also moved into the neighboring regions of Amhara and Afar. They hold much more territory now. So what's gone wrong?
When we were holding Mekelle and when our forces were in Tigray, there were constant issues that were being raised about humanitarian access, the humanitarian situation. We wanted to improve the humanitarian situation. And we're also concerned by the fact that the TPLF was sending wave after wave of civilians against our troops. There was an extensive use of child soldiers by the TPLF. So under these circumstances, to mitigate and minimize the humanitarian cost and suffering, we did the responsible thing. We declared a unilateral ceasefire and we withdrew our troops from Mekelle. Unfortunately, the TPLF continued with its aggression and belligerence and escalated the conflict. It expanded it into Afar and Amhara regional states, committing gross atrocities against civilians.
We'll get to the allegations of gross atrocities in a minute, but you tell me that you were concerned about the humanitarian situation. It's very hard for me to understand then why, to this very day, you and your government are maintaining a siege, a blockade of Tigray, which involves cutting off electricity, telecommunications, banking and financial services, something which the UN and other aid agencies say is materially affecting hundreds of thousands, millions of people.
When we declared the humanitarian unilateral ceasefire, we established a humanitarian corridor through Afar. It was the TPLF, the terrorist TPLF, that expanded the conflict and turned this corridor into a conflict zone.
Why don't you end the blockade, Mr. Attorney General?
As I said, we had facilitated humanitarian access and corridor through Afar. Now, as far as electricity and other essential services are concerned, the utility companies, the corporations that provide these services, they had several of their personnel killed in Tigray while they're trying to repair basic infrastructure. They have been subject to attacks. So under the existing insecurity, with the continued aggression of the TPLF, it would be difficult for these corporations to send their personnel, their employees, integral. So had the TPLF reciprocated the unilateral ceasefire, then there have been a different circumstance.
Well, but of course, as far as the Tigrayans are concerned, and I did speak to a Tigrayan spokesman very recently, you'll know that they believe that there is no way they can end their armed struggle until you end the blockade, and there's no sign of it ending. There are also worrying signs that your government sees the international aid agencies, the NGOs that are trying to deliver help to hundreds of thousands of people who are facing famine in Tigray. You appear to see them as part of the problem. One government spokesman, Redwan Hussein, recently referred to aid groups as playing a destructive role. What is that supposed to mean?
That's only a reference to a very small minority of organizations. The overwhelming majority of aid organizations are providing aid and assistance to those in need. We are cooperating with them. We facilitate their work. So we don't have a problem with that. And as I noted earlier, when we declared the unilateral ceasefire, our objective, our intent was for humanitarian aid to reach the people in Tigray without any hindrance. That's why we established the corridors to Afar. We allowed humanitarian flights to take off from Addis and fly to Mekelle, but the continued aggression from the side of the TPLF has created a situation on the ground that is making things more and more complicated.
I think people watching and listening to this conversation are going to find it hard to understand that while hundreds of thousands of people in the north of your country are facing the imminent threat of famine, hundreds of thousands have been displaced, are currently living in camps. You, in your government, have suspended the operations of various aid organizations, including Médecins Sans Frontières Holland branch, and also the Norwegian Refugee Council. Why on earth have you done that?
You have to understand that all the organizations that provide assistance and aid that operate in our territory have to respect our rules and regulations. As I have mentioned earlier, the overwhelming majority of humanitarian organizations have no problem with this, and they continue to provide assistance and aid.
These organizations are trying to keep people alive, and you're stopping them operating.
That's not the case. There has been administrative measures, but these measures are to ensure compliance with the appropriate regulations. As I have stated earlier, several organizations, numbering in the hundreds, are operating all over the country, providing assistance for those in need. We don't have a problem with them. We're working with them. We have a very constructive relationship. And we are also in consultation, in dialogue with these entities you have mentioned. And we believe that they will be able to rectify the violations very soon and will be able to reinstate their license.
You are Ethiopia's Attorney General. Have you read the report from the University of Ghent in Belgium that went forensically through lists of people, named individuals, civilians who have been killed in the fighting in Tigray? They have come up with 2,562 civilians who died in 232 incidents, which the University of Ghent researchers are calling massacres in Tigray over the last several months. Have you read that report, and what have you done about it?
We take all such allegations, all such reports seriously. We look into it. We conduct investigations. We are committed to ensuring accountability. The government of Ethiopia does not condone any such violations. And as we have tried to communicate to the public at large previously, we have conducted several investigations. There are additional investigations that are underway, both through the civilian and military tracks. And whenever we identify perpetrators, to the extent we find these kind of reports credible, we take measures to ensure accountability.
Amnesty International have released a report this month, again, using more than 60 testimonies from eyewitnesses, which they say provides overwhelming evidence of systematic sexual abuse, rape, and other terrible forms of sexual abuse carried out by Ethiopian army forces in Tigray since the beginning of this conflict. When you talk about justice and accountability, what have you done about that?
We are conducting and we have conducted investigations. We have several of our own soldiers responsible. Many have been court-martialed. There are ongoing investigations. These are things we take seriously. We don't condone this kind of behavior. We don't tolerate this kind of human rights violations. But I must also point out that some of these reports you have mentioned, there is a tendency to sensationalize. There is a tendency to draw very sweeping conclusions that are not supported by the extent and scope of the investigation. Some of them have also adapted methodologies that we think are rather flawed. Be that as it may, as I have said earlier, both through a civilian track and a military track. We have conducted investigations.
I find it hard to believe your government is taking these allegations seriously when one of your own spokespeople described the Amnesty International report as nothing more than sensationalized attacks and smears. If you were serious about these terrible allegations, which involve accusations of victims being held in captivity for days and being systematically raped, some being handed over for sexual slavery, some being raped in front of their children, if you took these accusations seriously, you would have dozens and dozens of members of your armed forces behind bars right now.
As I've said, these kind of matters are matters we take seriously. Yes, there could be sensationalized reports, and there are sensationalized reports drawing very exaggerated and unsubstantiated conclusions, but we take the victim seriously. We have conducted investigations, and more than dozens of our own soldiers have been sentenced to serious, serious penalties, some including to life in prison. More than 30. So our action speaks for itself. And in addition to this, I want to point out that the Ethiopian Armed Forces, the Ethiopian National Defense Force, is a disciplined fighting force. It is a force that has a long track record of serving within the UN framework, going back as far as the Korean War and in several parts of the continent. Its reputation for discipline, for integrity, is there for all to see.
Mr. Attorney General, but if you're telling me more than 30 soldiers have been convicted of the most serious sexual crimes in the course of this conflict over the last few months, there is clearly something much deeper going on. How many senior commanders of the Ethiopian military have been fired and held to account for what their men are doing? Because this isn't just a one-off, this is systematic. If you read the Amnesty International report, that is quite plain.
We don't agree with their conclusion that this was systematic. They have conducted their report, their investigation remotely. They have relied on what they call community workers. We are very skeptical of who those community workers might be. We conduct our investigations on the ground. And as far as accountability is concerned, our commitment, our seriousness, has also been demonstrated by the fact that we have allowed the UN High Commission for Human Rights to conduct a joint investigation with the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission. Only a government that is transparent, that is committed to the highest standards and values, would permit this kind of scrutiny.
Attorney General, you're right to point to this joint investigation, and the UN Human Rights Commissioner is involved. She says she takes the Amnesty International report very seriously. But there's another very profound problem here. You're the Attorney General of Ethiopia. Some of these allegations of the most extreme sexual violence come as allegations directed to Eritrean troops operating at the invitation of your government on your territory. You have no ability to deliver justice and accountability for the crimes committed by Eritrean troops, do you?
Regardless of who the perpetrators might be, our responsibility and our position is that we conduct investigations, we establish the facts. If there are individuals who are beyond our jurisdiction, there are established protocols and procedures to seek international legal cooperation, to work in collaboration with the authorities that have jurisdiction in neighboring countries. So this is a process that is underway. We work with neighboring countries on these kind of issues. So I think it's too early to jump to conclusions. And I would say that based on our actions and our conduct so far, our commitment to accountability is very clear. I must also point out that we are rather disappointed and a bit dismayed by the fact that several atrocities that are being committed by the terrorist TPLF against civilians, including children, is not being denounced. It's not being looked into by international human rights organizations.
If you had watched my interview with the spokesman for the TPLF, you will know that I went into great detail.
I would like to acknowledge that, and I do recognize that.
Thank you. It's important that we challenge both sides in this conflict. Let's get back to your side. Let's get back to the language being used by your own Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, who just last month used these words to describe the Tigray People's Liberation Front. He described them as a cancer, as weeds, as a disease. He said that these weeds will be removed from our country. As Attorney General, in a climate where there are accusations of ethnic cleansing, war crimes, crimes against humanity, what do you think of the language being used by your own Prime Minister?
The statement issued by the Office of the Prime Minister was referring to a terrorist organization. There have been instances in the past in which notable world leaders have used similar language to refer to terrorist organizations like ISIS. You know, given the pain and agony that the TPLF is causing to the people of Ethiopia, not just the recent massacres and atrocities it has committed, but what has transpired over the past three decades, that is a sentiment that most Ethiopians share.
The problem is that what we see happening in the country is that, for example, in Addis Ababa, it's quite plain over the last couple of months, hundreds of ethnic Tigrayan people have been rounded up and detained by your security forces. We see in reaction the American USAID chief, Samantha Power, saying dehumanizing rhetoric hardens tensions and can historically accompany ethnically motivated atrocities. Do you understand why the international community is increasingly concerned by what they see and hear coming from your government?
The TPLF has legitimately been designated as a terrorist organization by our parliament. Anyone who supports, provide material assistance or sponsors this kind of organization would have to be held accountable. The TPLF happens to be an organization organized along ethnic lines. So most of its supporters, most of its operatives or financiers happen to be, not all of them, but most of them happen to be from one ethnic group. So sometimes some outsiders might not understand this context, this situation and the challenge we face. So I understand where they are coming from, but they also have to understand the environment within which we are operating.
What do you think are the prospects for the continued unity of your country? The leader of the TPLF said not long ago, Mr. Gebremichael, he said, trust has broken completely. And if they don't want us, referring to you in the Addis government, if they don't want us, why should we stay? There is a real risk of your country falling apart, isn't there?
It's not falling apart. You have to remember, this is a very ancient and very resilient nation. We have overcome all sorts of challenge in our long history. When we come united, when we are determined, and I believe there is a determination and resolve to neutralize the threat we face from the TPLF, we can overcome this challenge. The TPLF seems to be intent on either destroying Ethiopia. It doesn't seem to be willing to tolerate an Ethiopia that it can't dominate, that it can't rule. And its objective of either reasserting hegemony or dismembering Ethiopia, these are not objectives acceptable to the people of Ethiopia.
There really doesn't seem to be a unified position now amongst all of the people of all of Ethiopia. I'm just very mindful of what Abiy Ahmed said when he won that Nobel Peace Prize back in December 2019. He said, before we can harvest peace dividends, we must plant seeds of love, forgiveness and reconciliation in the hearts and minds of our citizens. Very far from love, forgiveness and reconciliation, your government right now seems intent on crushing the Tigrayan rebels, eliminating the so-called cancer, and that doesn't sound like love, reconciliation and forgiveness.
We have practiced forgiveness, we have practiced reconciliation. I mean, when the new administration came to power, the sins and transgressions of the TPLF were forgiven. The TPLF was given an opportunity to be part of the body politic of the Ethiopian state, despite the gross and systematic human rights violations and misrule. There are repeated efforts on the part of this government to find amicable solutions for the differences we had with the TPLF. It is the TPLF that triggered the conflict. It is the TPLF that dragged us into this conflict. You have to remember that this is not a conflict that we chose. It is a conflict that has been imposed upon us when the TPLF attacked the Northern Command.
But there is no military solution, is there, Mr. Attorney General? In the end, this will have to be resolved through dialogue and compromise. And right now, your government isn't talking the language of dialogue and compromise.
When we declared a unilateral ceasefire, we're giving peace a chance. But I'm sorry,
your Prime Minister just told the nation that all able-bodied civilians should join the fight to crush the Tigrayan rebels. That's not a ceasefire.
When we declared the unilateral ceasefire, the TPLF, instead of reciprocating that unilateral ceasefire, expanded the conflict. It went on the offensive into Afar, into the Amara regional state. It displaced hundreds of thousands. It killed hundreds of civilians. Under these circumstances, what are we expected to do? The TPLF, as a terrorist organization, with its continued belligerence and aggression, made the ceasefire untenable. Under these circumstances, we have a right and responsibility to defend our population, and that's what we're doing.
Gedeon Timoteos, we have to end there, but I thank you very much indeed for joining me from Addis Ababa.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is made possible by American Public Media with support from GEP. GEP helps businesses build resilient supply chains with strategy, services, and cloud-native software, including GEP Smart and GEP Next, AI-based digital procurement and supply chain platforms. And Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Viking offers a small ship experience with cultural enrichment and destination-focused dining. More at Viking.com.
Parents sending their kids back to school face a patchwork of safety measures and a choice.
I'm paralyzed. I'm paralyzed with the decision I have to make.
In Wisconsin, a mother feels she has to move.
I don't want my child to be the one who dies in order for them to act.
Switching schools over masks on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's This Morning from 5 to 9 a.m. here on 91.5 WBEZ.